The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and exercise is today's theme. You know, the prospect of starting an exercise program is daunting for many people. So the question is often, do you have the heart to start? Well, actually, that's the title of a book that we're going to review today with the author, Dr. James Beckerman. The subtitle of the book, Heart to Start, is the 8-week exercise prescription to live longer, beat heart disease, and run your best rate. And one of the premises of the book is that, no matter what shape you're in, you can actually complete a modest competitive race. The author, Dr. James Beckerman, is a cardiologist. He's medical director of the Center for Prevention and Wellness out in Portland, Oregon. And he directs the cardiac rehab program at Providence St. Vincent's Medical Center. He also, and we'll tell you a little bit about this program, he's the founder and medical director of Play Smart Youth Heart Screenings, because from time to time we hear of terrible tragedies, young, very fit athletes, college basketball players, high school basketball players who drop dead on the court. What's up with that? We'll find out. Dr. Beckerman graduated from Harvard College. He earned his doctorate from Harvard Medical School. He couldn't get away from the Boston area, then went on to the Massachusetts General Hospital and on to Stanford Hospital on the West Coast. And he is on the clinical advisory board of WebMD and Fitness Magazine. And so without further ado, here's our guest, Dr. James Beckerman. It's a pleasure having you on. Hi, how are you? It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
You know, your academic credentials are impeccable. Congratulations to you, and great that you're getting involved in this advocacy. What prompted you to write this book? You actually describe your own personal experience that actually propelled you to become a cardiologist, but you didn't want to just become a run-of-the-mill cardiologist dishing medication, and you felt you had a higher calling to save lives.
It's true. I actually went into this thinking I was going to be a psychiatrist. That was always my ambition. Hmm. And I loved the idea of talking with people, discussing their personal obstacles and barriers and challenges. And ironically, I found that as a cardiologist, I get to do that too. But going back many years ago when I was a third-year medical student, I was on a vacation with my girlfriend's family in a rural part of northwest Iowa called Lake Okoboji. And about three nights into our trip there together, very tragically, her father had a heart attack. And unfortunately, we were not able to revive him. And for me, something changed that night in a lot of ways, honestly. But what really changed was my perspective on what I wanted to do for my career and how I could try to help other families, other people, try to keep things together, try to keep things moving forward, and try to avoid tragedies like this from affecting other folks.
So it gave you more of a preventive focus.
It absolutely did. And while cardiology is an incredible field these days, we're implanting heart valves through tiny incisions in people's legs, and we have pacemakers the size of nickels. For me, the ultimate goal is to try to keep folks as healthy as they can be and motivated to want to be healthy moving forward so they don't have to have those fancy technologies down the line.
So what percentage, it's hard to assign, but, as a sort of a general statement. What percentage of cardiovascular disease that passes through your office, I know that you're a mainstream cardiologist, but what percentage of it could be averted with proper lifestyle methods or ameliorated?
I feel like everybody's amazed when they hear the statistic that approximately 80% of heart disease is preventable. And I think it's natural. It's very human for us to look at our moms and our dads and our grandparents as our major provider of risk. You know, if you're worried about losing your hair, you look at your parents and grandparents.
Right.
But when it comes to heart disease, while genetics obviously does play a role and it results in predispositions to high cholesterol or high blood pressure, what have you, it really does turn out that about 80% of that global risk of you having a heart attack is up to the stuff that you do every day, the decisions you make. And that's why I just think that there's an amazing opportunity here for us as healthcare providers and for the public to basically get together, get our minds around this prevention thing, and finally start crafting a more motivating message that's goal-directed and gets people out there to change their behaviors.
So in other words, your genes are not necessarily your destiny. You may be somewhat predisposed, but through epigenetics, through behaviors, you can modify your genetic risk to some degree. I mean, life is not entirely a merit system, as we've all learned, but to some extent, you can overcome risk through some of the right measures.
Yeah, I don't know who said it first, but the idea that we can nurture nature.
Oh, good.
That always sticks with me because, you have the cards that you've been dealt, but then it's how you play them that matters. And a lot of us, unfortunately, aren't really playing them as aggressively or as cleverly or as thoughtfully as we might. And so instead of that sounding depressing, I like to turn it into a positive.
Well, in your book, you make a rather stark statement for someone who wants to promote a popular book. You say, and I'm quoting here, "This program is not intended to make you lose weight." So, like, at the risk of losing,
right,
9/10 of your audience, I mean, my goodness, that's a pretty bold confession.
Exactly, and it was very purposeful because I do think that we have been lulled into into thinking that the purpose of exercise is to lose weight. And sadly, our media has kind of helped propagate that idea with popular television shows where we see people on treadmills for hours at a time and fainting and getting sick and being yelled at. All of this idea that we're going to lose weight by punishing ourselves with fitness. And it's time to change that conversation. I think we really need to consider that there's more to exercise than weight loss. And in fact, it turns out that unless you are exercising to excess, for most of us, exercise is not going to make a big difference in our weights. It's more about other positive things that I think are important, even other than weight loss.
And what might those be? So is it possible to, perhaps you don't meet your optimal weight goal. You're still, carrying 15 extra pounds. Because, at that point, is exercise futile?
Oh, it's a great question. And what has been amazing is that researchers have found that for folks who, even if they are carrying a little bit of extra weight by kind of conventional standards, by body mass index standards, if you are fit, if you exercise regularly, and you can take care of those risk factors that we talk about, like the blood pressure and the cholesterol and the blood sugar that are impacted by exercise in incredible ways, then all of a sudden your risk for heart disease plummets, even in spite of the fact that you may be 10 pounds, 20 pounds, 30 pounds overweight. And so I think that that's pretty reassuring, in that even if we can't meet society's standards of what is perfect or healthy or beautiful necessarily by a number on a scale, we can do amazing things for ourselves that'll keep us healthy, keep us happy, keep us moving forward. And so that to me is a far more positive message than the one that we get from seeing folks falling off of treadmills and not feeling good about themselves because they somehow aren't exercising enough.
The exercise until you puke school of thought.
It's crazy, and it's out there, sadly. And I think that, unfortunately, we're buying it because at least it does seem to promise something, even if it's something that isn't healthy.
And conversely, we can see people, and I know you're aware of studies, that show that people of normal weight or even underweight are at higher metabolic risk for cardiovascular disease. And there's actually some suggestion there's a paradoxical effect when people pass a certain age that maybe having a couple extra pounds may reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, and they call that the obesity paradox, and it's fascinating. People don't really understand it so well. Is it possible that having a few extra pounds on board provides some semblance of reserve in case you do get ill from whatever cause? It's not really certain. But what it really shows us is that there are so many variables at play here, and traditionally we have been focusing on the number on the scale rather than what you do. And, you know, even for folks who are highly motivated, it can be very hard to budge that number on the scale, but it's much easier to impact what you do each day. And so there's an opportunity here to engage people, to make us feel good about ourselves. That I think that as a healthcare system, we haven't been doing a great job of. And so my hope is to get that message out there and make it motivating and interesting and different and get people moving.
Indeed. You know, I know you did well in physics because you got into Harvard and you know about the law of thermodynamics. And, you know, I think it's well ingrained in the popular imagination. And, you know, people will sometimes put on the feed bag and then they'll say, well, I need to exercise because I need to burn off the calories. Or maybe they'll, you know, before like Thanksgiving dinner, they'll pay it forward and they'll look at, they actually now have devices on your treadmill or on your elliptical machine that tell you how many calories you burn. And, you know, according to basic laws of physics and thermodynamics, 3,500 calories equals 1 pound. So you do 3,500 calories, you can lose a pound, right or wrong?
Sounds pretty easy, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
Except, it seems like things don't really work out the way that you intended them to. I mean, and we've all done it, right? You know, you're out for dinner and you think about having that slice of pie or piece of cake, or you're celebrating some event and you do this mental calculus and say, okay, well, if I do this, then I have to make up for it in some other way, which sets up an incredible tension between the food that you eat and the exercise that you do. And it often casts exercise in a negative light because it is literally a punishment for that slice of cake or that burger or whatever else you were enjoying. And that seems like a pretty unhealthy way to think about activity as a punishment. And so I think that's an important responsibility for us as healthcare providers to try to change that narrative and help people recognize, listen, you know, it's one thing to eat this or that, but it's another thing to do this or that. They're different. And even though, yes, the laws of thermodynamics will hold true on some level, it's how you think about it that impacts whether you're going to lace up those shoes in the morning or feel bad about enjoying a slice of cake. We do these things to ourselves constantly. We're self-defeating so much, and we need to break that cycle.
And it makes us a little skitsy because on the one hand, you know, we engage in hedonism and then we scourge ourselves, and that results in, you know, sort of a, you know, you being of a psychological bent, kind of a skitsy attitude towards health.
I agree. It just doesn't feel consistent. I think that we should be able to enjoy many different types of food and some in more moderation than others, clearly. But at the same time, be able to enjoy our bodies and enjoy activity and feel positive about what we're doing every day. So I think that we need to center ourselves a little bit and get a little bit more zen rather than yin-yang about the way we think of diet and exercise.
Or yo-yo.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, before we get to the program that you advocate, it's a practical program that can take you from couch to 5K. You didn't coin that term, but you know that's essentially what your book helps to promote. Let's look at some weight loss reality show non-realities. I like this section of your book. Number one, physicians believe that it is safe to lose a significant amount of weight, i.e. much more than 2 pounds, every week. True or false?
I'm thinking that that's a weight loss reality show non-reality, because here in the real world, we know that if somebody is losing 5 pounds even, or 10 pounds in a week, or whatever the promise du jour is, you're doing something that's probably not good for your body, and that's clearly not sustainable. And sustainability is the most important word that we can use when it comes to lifestyle change. Because if it's not something you can imagine doing next week or next year or in 5 years, then as soon as you stop doing it, you're going to go back to where you were before. And you're going to consider yourself a failure, too. And that's no good.
And here's another reality show, non-reality, according to your book. Trainers believe that it's safe to exercise 4 to 6 hours a day to the point of crying, passing out, or vomiting.
Yeah, it sounds delightful, yet millions of Americans click on the tube each week to watch this happen in real time. I think that anybody who exercises 4 to 6 hours a day should either have an Ironman triathlon on their schedule or maybe be seeing a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
And I say that in jest, but what I mean is that if you're pushing yourself so hard, you got to really think about why you're doing it. Is it for health? Is it for beauty? Is it for performance? And it turns out that for about 99.9% of the population, it's not a healthy way to go. And so if we're in a cycle where we feel that we need to do that kind of activity to be healthy, then I think that we're giving ourselves some unfair expectations. We got to change that.
Yeah, and also what that does ultimately is it undermines the consistency aspect. You're courting injury, accident, or burnout, and you know clearly that's what we want. A lifetime career of athleticism, not just sporadic bursts of enthusiasm, like I'm going to run the marathon, and next year I'll spend my entire year going to the sports medicine doctor to iron out the kinks.
Exactly.
And finally, nutritionists believe that the purpose of exercise is to lose weight and place less emphasis on the role of a healthy diet. And you find something lacking in that proposition as well.
I certainly do. It's interesting when you see a weight loss reality show, you don't really hear much about what the participants are eating. You don't really get a great insight as to what dietary approach they're using, although I think there's an assumption out there that it's a very low-calorie one. But it's not so much about quality. Instead, we watch people sweating it out in the gym and all those other kinds of things we were talking about. And so in the real world, I think that there's wonderful advice that we can get from our nutritionist and registered dietitian colleagues, where they have insight that the majority of weight loss is going to come from the quality and quantity of your diet. And while I'm sure that exercise is recommended as well, it's an adjunct. It's part of the whole picture. But it's not the primary way that you're going to get your body into weight loss shape, so to speak.
Okay. Well, from the standpoint of heart disease, you know, you see a lot of people who come to you for a preventive program, and these days the sum total of preventive programs for cardiovascular disease, unfortunately, is boiled down to, you know, which statin should you put a patient on, and there's some preventive benefit to that, although that remains controversial as to primary prevention. So who is this program for? You're recommending exercise to prevent cardiovascular disease, but what if someone has already had cardiovascular, they've had a stent, they've had bypass surgery, or perhaps even had a heart attack? Surely you don't mean those people should be exercising, or do you?
I certainly do. And what's, I think, also really surprising to folks is the wealth of research that we have on the benefits of exercise in a quote-unquote higher-risk population. Now, none of us wants to think of ourselves as higher risk, but those of us who have been diagnosed with heart disease or who have undergone heart surgery, understandably, we're terrified of the prospect of having to go through those experiences again. So if there's anything that
or even dropping dead, because, I mean, a phenomenon, it's a well-known phenomenon that you're familiar with, which is that once people are made aware of the fact that they have cardiovascular disease, they become cardiac cripples, in effect. They become sedentary, they become fearful of exertion. And, of course, that's precisely the opposite of what they need.
Yeah, and I think that it's sad that folks have gotten that message that once they have been diagnosed or even find themselves at higher risk because of their blood pressure or diabetes or what have you, that they basically need to sit around and wait for something bad to happen. But what I've been so inspired by with our 5K training programs or the folks that I've taken care of through cardiac rehabilitation is that exercising, it literally is medicine, and it lowers people's future risk of hospitalization or death from heart disease by about 25 to 30%, which really rivals or is better, frankly, than any of the data that you'll get out of any of the pharmaceuticals that you might be prescribed.
Wait, I want you to reiterate that, because that's a really an amazing statement. Please repeat that, because I think that's actually one of the key take-home messages of this podcast. Yeah. Is that exercise, let's say exercise were a brand new drug, Pfizer, you know, invented vitamin X, which is exercise, and they tested it, you know, double-blind placebo-controlled trials, and it came out as a new medication. Its cost, its safety profile, and its effectiveness would trump all the heavy-duty medications that we now have on the market?
It's absolutely stunning, and that I think that number is really useful for people to hear, 25 to 30% risk reduction. So obviously it's not 100, but it's 25 to 30%. And not only are you lowering your risk of heart disease or death related to heart disease, but you're lowering your risk of dementia, breast cancer, stroke, endometrial cancer, fracture, all these other medical conditions that even for the folks who aren't so concerned about their heart disease risk, I mean, the fact is that something's going to get all of us. And so if there's something that we can do to push that something further away, make it later in life, who knows? Exercise is that thing. And any of us who've taken care of older individuals know that there's so many ways to live those older years of your life. And when you see somebody who's been active throughout their lives and who embraces it well into their 70s and 80s, it's absolutely transformative. Absolutely. And so I think that we would be doing ourselves and our patients a huge injustice if we didn't emphasize that now is the time. It doesn't matter what you've been through. It doesn't matter what you've experienced. You get to be a healthier version of yourself, and exercise will be one of the keys to that.
Just to provide a little counterforce on this, to be the devil's advocate, there are some studies that are emerging that suggest that high-level exercisers, there's a sort of a sweet spot for exercise, or what we call in statistics a U-shaped curve, where there's a point at which there are diminishing returns. Past a certain point, one may have a higher risk for heart enlargement or cardiac arrhythmias. Is that a danger with the program that you're advocating?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting area of research and of controversy, as you might guess, as to whether there may be a ceiling, as to whether, like you said, a law of diminishing returns, as to whether too much of a certain type of exercise may cause changes in our bodies that aren't as good. I think that while the jury's still out to some extent on that, there's a few things that we do know. We do know that atrial fibrillation, which is a very common abnormal heart rhythm that tends to impact folks more as we grow older, there certainly seems to be a higher risk in folks who do a lot of high-volume exercise.
We're talking about marathoners, ultra-marathoners, Ironman triathletes, and so on.
Cyclists and the like.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, it turns out that for the vast majority of us, those aren't necessarily our first goals right out of the gate.
It should only be your problem that you're exercising too much.
Exactly. I think it's an uncommon situation, and, you know, cross that bridge if and when we come to it. But in the meantime, for folks who are trying to kind of get out of the gates and do something new for themselves, the good news is that it should be very safe from a cardiac standpoint. Obviously, I recommend that anybody engaging in a new exercise program, it's worthwhile to have that couple of minute conversation with your own doctor, make sure that it's okay for you, and that especially if you have a heart condition, that there's nothing about it that would preclude you getting started. So the message, though, is we want to be inclusive here and get more people on board.
So it's sort of like the Viagra commercials. Ask your doctor if you're healthy enough for exercise,
right.
Not sex.
Yeah, and I think it's a fair thing to say. I mean, we say it in jest a little bit, but we want to make sure that anybody taking any type of medicine, even if it's a natural type of medicine in the form of exercise, we want to make sure that it's safe.
Okay, well, this is a great prelude to what we're going to talk about in part two. We divide our podcast into two parts, so you got the message. Let's get going. Let's promote exercise at all ages, whether it's for cardiovascular prevention or whether it's for secondary prevention. You have a heart problem and you want to reverse it. In part two with today's guest, Dr. James Beckerman, we're going to talk practicalities. We're going to talk about how you can launch your own personal exercise program and undertake your best race, even run in a competitive event. And if you think that prospect is daunting, Dr. Beckerman is here to tell you that it's something you can attain. We'll also talk in part two about a rare but tragic problem, sudden death among young competitive athletes, sometimes in high school, sometimes in college. This is a personal interest of Dr. Beckerman's, and we'll talk about prevention of this type of problem. He's involved in a program to find potential hazards for young athletes. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. The book is Heart to Start, the 8-week exercise prescription to live longer, beat heart disease, and run your best race. And I hope you'll join us for part two of today's Intelligent Medicine podcast.